earth, that has to do with learning how to have power. The greatest, most powerful mind state you could know how danger settings. And those things are very powerful. So it can create real harm, you know. So it's not talked about. I mean, the Buddha was very quiet about a lot of the psychic powers and so-called psychic powers, or super-sensory powers, maybe you call it, which Kundalini, moving the Kundalini into the higher stages and, you know, and taking it up to the heart and actually opening those doors and then moving it down again. And you know, it's hidden, it's all through all of Buddhism, certainly in the Tibetan, when you have the Vajrasattva mantra, you got the ha-ha-ha-ha-ho, you know, it's like the four stages, and then it descends again, and doing it the other way. It's usually translated as the four joys. Well, that's polite, isn't it? Who's going to know that's the whole teaching on, you know, on Tantra, on moving the Kundalini, moving the energy? Nobody unless they're instructed, are they? Because all there, but you don't get that in public. So I'm not saying about anything about this in public. You don't get that in public. You don't have to burn sage tape, that's all there is. You don't get that explained in the public eye at all. Or even referred to, usually. You just say that precious human birth, impermanence. Because without those, you have the foundation. So people will be doing these other exercises. Very simple to do, as we all know. Very simple to do those, but the results are not so simple to deal with if you don't have a foundation. It causes havoc in people's lives. Does that answer you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you had a question?
Yes, when you talked about stream entry, you said there were three things.
Oh, I did, didn't I? Mm-hmm. What are the three?
Third one, no longer superstitious of mind. Then you said no belief in personal self, and you said another one.
Yeah, I remember it right now.
Okay.
When I remember, I'll tell you. My mind is full of the 37. Did you have a question that you can ask? No, you wanted to say something, didn't you? And I just went barking ahead without... Just sit up here. Do you want to say something now, or do you want to wait? It's probably a good time for tea break, is it? Or should we go for another half hour? How are you doing? Now or wait? Could I have a show of hands for now? Could I have a show of hands for wait? Okay, now has it. We're going to take a break. We'll meet at 11:25, 20 minutes. Just for developing, we've discussed the first stages of the sitting practice. And we've done a little bit of work with that. So have you found that useful so far?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen it making a difference in your practice? Yeah, some of you. Some of you, yes. Some of you, no. Good. So I'm going back to Mahasi Sayadaw's text to just talk a little bit about the walking practice. Yeah, could you just turn that off then, please? Are you cool still? Thanks. It's off. The red light seems to be fading, isn't it?
That heat is surely separate.
Yeah, okay. So then they're involved in the whole course of a meditation practice. Then when you intend to move, if you're going to do a walking practice, you say intention, 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 and you start moving your body. And then you start to stand, you say standing, and you observe standing, because again, what you're trying to do is get past the habitual sense of yourself and see what standing really is. So you're not, if you're doing it right, you're not doing it right. If you're just curious, what is mind and what is body, that's what the first stages of Four Foundations of Mindfulness teach you. What is mind and what is body? And if you're successful in this, you will have all of a sudden a clear image of, or a clear felt sense of your body standing, and then like a beat set later, the mental image of yourself standing. And you will know, oh, that's body, that's mind. And there will be a slight difference in them. When I have tried to describe this difference to people in other ways, the only way I came up that was anywhere close, people have done meditation saying, well, why should I meditate? And I would say to them, and I would put a glass of water in front of them, and I would, you know, in a hot day, and I would say, imagine your hand, putting your hand around that cool glass of water. And really imagine it, like you're sitting here, there it is right there. Imagine what it would feel like to hold it. I would walk them through all the stages of sipping it, and then I'd say, now do it. It's a very nice thing for you to do as well. Watch that difference between when you're imagining yourself doing something and doing something, so that you actually begin to see why you want to have less habituation of mind, be less motivated by habituation and more presence in the moment. Does that make sense to you? Very nice. Continuously pay attention to yourself. What is the difference between body and what is the difference between mind projecting body? And again, I reiterate, I am not saying that one is better than the other. If we could not mentally project body, we would not be human. The question is are you choosing it or are you being overruled? Are you living totally in a dream? Or are you occasionally allowed to take over the control? So, well, in the course of the contemplation, if the meditator feels thirsty, should make a mental note of this feeling, such as thirsty. And so then, this is if you're doing a whole daily retreat, if you're doing a retreat, and then if you feel it tends to stand up, say intending, then make a mental note of each action of movement in preparing yourself for standing up, leaning forward. See, so you're teaching your mind to not just go on automatic, you're actually bringing your consciousness into the movement. That's what you're doing. I know I'm going over this again and again, but it's like the number one point that people forget. Yeah. It's very hard to break the habituation of knowing what you're doing. So like, this is what you're working with here. You're teaching yourself how to be present in your actions. So you slow them down and you make your mind name what is happening, not go ahead to what you think you're going to do. You're not wondering which glass you're going to get when you're starting to stand up. He should keep his mind intently on the act of standing up, make a mental note such as standing. When he looks forward, as soon as he has stood up straightly, he will make a mental note such as looking, seeing. When he intends to go forward, intending, he should make, when he begins to step forward, make a mental note of each step, such as saying, walking, or left, right. While walking, it is important to know completely every movement in each step from the beginning to the end. The same procedure should be adopted when he is taking a stroll or walking exercise to and fro. The disciple should try and make a mental note of each step in two sections, such as lifting, putting, lifting, putting. Or he's getting sufficient practice. In this manner, he should try and make a mental note of each step in three sections, such as lifting, pushing, putting, up, forward, down. When he looks at the water pot or tap, as soon as he reaches the place, he should make a mental note, such as looking, seeing, when he stops, stopping, when he stretches his hand, stretching, stretching. When the hand touches the cup, touching, touching. When the hand catches hold of the cup, catching, catching. When the hand dips the cup in the water, dipping, dipping. When the hand brings the cup to the mouth, bringing, bringing. When the cup touches the lips, touching, touching. When he feels cold at the touch, cold, cold. When he swallows, swallowing, swallowing. When he returns the cup, returning, returning. When he withdraws his hand, withdrawing, withdrawing. When he puts down his hand, putting, putting. When the hand touches the side of the body, touching, touching. When he intends to turn back, intending, intending. When he turns around, turning, turning. When he marches forward, walking, walking. On reaching the place where he intends to stop, intending, intending. When he stops, stopping, stopping. If he keeps on standing for some time, proceed with the usual contemplation of rising and falling. If he intends to sit down, intending, intending. When he goes to the place for sitting down, walking, walking. When he reaches the place, reaching, reaching. When he turns to sit, turning, turning. When he intends to sit, intending, intending. When he is in the act of sitting, sitting, sitting. He should sit down slowly and also keep his mind on the downward notion. Mental notes should also be made of every action of his movements and bringing his legs and hands into position. He should then proceed with his usual contemplation of rising, falling. When he intends to lie down, intending, intending, he should then proceed with the contemplation on every action of movement in the course of lying down, such as lifting, lifting, stretching, stretching, leaning, leaning, and so on. When he lies down, lying, lying, when his body touches the flat pillow, touching, touching, again he should proceed with contemplation of every action of movement in bringing his hands, legs, and body into position. These actions should be carried out slowly. Then he should proceed with the usual contemplation of rising and falling. If he feels pain, or feels hot, or feels tired, or feels itching, or feels any sensation, he should make a mental note of that sensation. Contemplation of various actions in swallowing and spitting, of feelings of pain, and any other sensations, of various occurrences of thought, ideas, considerations, reflections, various actions of movement of hands, legs, and body should be carried out as is usually done in the sitting posture. If there is nothing particular of note, the disciple should carry on with the usual contemplation of the rising and falling of the breath. If he then feels sleepy, he should make a mental note, such as sleepy, sleepy. If he feels drowsy, drowsy. After the disciple has gained sufficient concentration in contemplation, he may find that the sleepy or drowsy feeling passes away soon after, and he will feel fresh again. He will then proceed with the usual contemplation of rising, falling. Though he may not be able to overcome the feeling of drowsiness, he should not stop, but carry on with his contemplation until he falls asleep. Sleep is nothing but a state of bhavanga santana, the continuity of subconsciousness is how he translates that. It is similar to the first state of rebirth consciousness and the last state of consciousness at the moment of death. This state of consciousness is feeble and is not in a position to know any object. During waking life, this state of bhavanga regularly occurs between moments of seeing, hearing, thinking, and so forth. But as the occurrence of this state of Bhavanga does not naturally last long, it is not generally clear and noticeable. This state of Bhavanga continues for a long time during sleep, so therefore it becomes obvious. During sleep, no contemplation is feasible. On awakening, that's in deep sleep, what we would call deep sleep. On awakening, the disciple should start with the contemplation of the first moments of awakening, which you can usually catch as you're waking up. By the time you can be, should be able to be aware when there's dreams occurring in whilst you're asleep, and then the moving back away from dream into deep sleep. And you should also be able to watch yourself wake up. On awakening, the disciple should start with the contemplation of the first moments of awakening, such as awakening and awakening. For a beginner, it may not be possible to start from the first moment of awakening. It should, however, start from the moment he remembers. For instance, if he becomes aware of the fact that he is reflecting, he should at once start his contemplation from this point, such as reflecting or thinking or whatever. He should afterward proceed with the usual contemplation of rising and falling. Every detailed action of the movement in turning, bending, stretching his body, hands, and legs should be contemplated. If he thinks of the time, he should make a mental note, such as thinking, rather than letting the object of your thought be the ruling thinking. If he intends to get up, intending, if he prepares to gather his body into a position for getting up, preparing, as he raises up his body, slowly getting up, when he comes to sitting position, sitting, remaining in the sitting position, he shouldn't proceed with the usual contemplation of rising and falling. While the disciple is in the act of washing his face or taking a bath, he should carry out these acts with due contemplation. With due contemplation, every detailed action of the movement in its order, such as looking, seeing, stretching, holding, dipping, carrying, pouring, feeling cold, rubbing, and so on. While in the act of adjusting his dress or arranging his bed, opening or closing a door, handling or taking up anything, he should be occupied with the contemplation of every detail of his actions in their respective order. He should similarly be occupied with the contemplation of every detail of his actions when he is partaking of food, when he looks at the food, looking, seeing, when he arranges the food with his hand, arranging, when he brings the food to the mouth, bringing, when he bends his neck forward, bending, when the food touches the lips, touching, when he places the food in the mouth, placing, when he shuts the mouth, shutting, when he withdraws his hand, withdrawing, when his hand touches the plate, touching, because you eat out of a bowl with your hand. This is monastic instruction. when he withdraws his hand, withdrawing, when his hand touches the plate, touching, when he straightens his neck, straightening, when he chews, chewing, when he knows the taste, knowing, when he swallows the food, swallowing, when the food goes down the throat, touching the sides, touching. I was trained also to say tasting and really focus on the tongue and be aware of tasting. Down the throat, touching the sides, touching. Thus he should carry on his contemplation every time he partakes of each morsel of food until he finishes his meal. In the beginning of the practice, there will be many omissions. Really, it is, isn't it? However, the disciple should not waver in his endeavor, but persist in the practice. It's not what you don't do, it's what you do do. No judgment. It's not what you don't do, it's what you do. No judgment. So if you're judging, what you're doing is not meditating. If you're meditating, you're just seeing how much awareness you can bring into every action. you're just seeing, you're just exploring. Is this possible? And if I do this, does it make any reasonable difference in my life? You're going to see for yourself. That's all. Because you have the right to. It's your life. As he gains practice, he will find that he can carry on with fewer omissions. With more advanced practice, he will be able to know more details than those mentioned above. After having practiced for a day and a night, the disciple may find that his contemplation has advanced considerably. Thus, he can carry on with his usual contemplation of rising and falling easily. He will, at the same time, find that a break generally occurs between the movement and rising and falling, and of rising and moving. If he is in the sitting posture, he should fill in the break by making a mental note of the act of sitting as well, such as rising, falling, and then if there's a gap between the falling breath and the rising breath, then let the focus drop down in the body and feel the body and say, sitting. So, make a mental note on the act of sitting as well, such as rising, falling, sitting. And you hold the mind wherever the feeling of lower part of your body usually. I was taught to do it first with to the right, just by the right hip, just inside of the right, so the pelvis by the right hip there. Inside that, almost like in the groin there. So you go right, you're watching the abdomen here, rising, falling, and if there's a gap between the out-breath and the in-breath, sitting on the right. And you just hold your attention there until the breath starts to move itself. You don't try to extend that. As soon as the breath moves, you just go back. Rising, falling. You don't do a gap on the in-breath at the beginning. Sitting. What happens is that gap gets longer. Then you go rising, falling, sitting, sitting, rising, falling, sitting, sitting. The gap gets longer. We'll see whether, it's been a long time since I read this article, so we'll see whether the Hasi Sayadaw agrees with that he is the authority. He will at the same time find a break generally occurs between the movement of rising and moving. I think that should be rising and falling, but that's okay. If he is in the sitting posture, he should fill in the break by making a mental note on the act of sitting as well, such as rising, falling, sitting, rising, falling, sitting. While making such a note of sitting, he should keep his mind on the erect posture of his body. So that's usually the focus that's taught just very quickly, so mental posture, rising, falling, in the gap, pay attention to the overall feel of the body. Sitting, lying, standing, walking. And then if it becomes more when you're... What I was telling you was more of an advanced practice. But first, he's absolutely right on here. First, you just become aware that you are sitting or lying or standing. The mindfulness of the postures, right? He should keep his mind on the erect, while making such a note as sitting, he should keep his mind on the erect position of his body. If he's in lying posture, he should proceed rising, falling, lying, rising, falling, lying. If he still finds it easy, proceed with making a note of three sections. If he finds that a break generally occurs at the end of rising as well as the end of falling, rising. He should proceed with making notes such as rising, sitting, or lying, falling, sitting, or lying. So then you add the awareness of posture in the gap between the in-breath and out-breath and between the out-breath and in-breath. As soon as he does not find it easy to carry on with this manner of making a note on three or four sections, he reverts the usual manner of noting two sections, such as rising and falling. When the disciple is engaged in the ordinary mode of contemplating any movements of his body, he need not concern himself with any object of seeing or hearing. So long as he is able to keep his mind on the movements of rising and falling, it may be assumed that the purpose of keeping the mind on the mere point of seeing and hearing is also served. If, however, he happens to look intentionally at an object, he should at once make a mental note such as seeing two or three times, and then proceed with the usual contemplation of rising and falling. If any person, either male or female, happens to come in sight, he should make a mental note such as seeing two or three times, then proceed with his usual contemplation of rising and falling. If he happens to listen to any voice, he should make a mental note such as listening, hearing, and then proceed with his usual contemplation of rising and falling. If he happens to hear loud sounds such as barking of dogs, speaking songs, etc., he should at once make a mental note such as hearing two or three times, and then proceed with his usual contemplation of rising and falling. If he fails to contemplate on sights and voice of such distinctive nature as they occur, he may begin to dwell on reflections about those objects. Have you noticed? Instead of proceeding with his intense contemplation of rising and falling, which may become less distinct and clear. In this way, kalesas, which is mind-defiling passions, are bred and propagated. Kalesha means stain. Their tendency to get sidetracked by desire for an experience other than that which is present will take off. In this way, kleshas are bred and propagated. If such reflections occur, he should make a mental note. If such thoughts, if you find yourself when a song goes, your thoughts go, then you make it thinking. Such as reflecting two or three times, or thinking. And then proceed with his usual contemplation of rising and falling. On moving his body or any of his limbs, if he forgets or omits to make a mental note of these actions, he should make a mental note of these actions. He should simply make a mental note of these actions, such as forgetting. And then proceed with his usual contemplation. Sometimes he may feel that his breathing becomes slow and the movement of rising and falling are feeble and not clear. In this case, he should proceed with the contemplation of either sitting, touching, if he is in sitting posture, or lying, touching, if in lying posture. That is to say, you go to whatever is clear. If your main focus is the breath, there is a point where you are not going to be able to see your breath. It will become very fine, very subtle. And there are two ways you can work with it, depending on the instruction of your teacher. One way is to then go to whatever is clear. The other is to pick up the awareness, to go for the more subtle, to be aware of whatever is the feeling of movement in relation to the breath. And then this is the direction I would follow if I'm you. Go to. Sometimes he may feel that his breathing becomes slow and the movement of rising and falling are feeble and not clear. It actually feels like it disappeared. You feel like you're not breathing, but you don't feel like you have any problem with that. The mind is very calm. So then you go to what you do feel. In this case, you should proceed with the contemplation of how he's sitting, touching, if he's sitting posture, lying, touching, if in lying posture. While contemplating touching, his mind should not be kept on the same spot, but on different spots successively. So I was saying, like, you do, one, two, three, four, and so forth. Okay, there must be at least six or seven different places. So the mind is moving, you don't get fixed, the mind doesn't get fixed. This is the point, the mind now is practicing awareness of what is and it's not fixed. This is very skillful instruction, by the way. Everything you need to know about how to practice mindfulness. Because now the concentration is there and you're using your mind to develop energy, right? From the five moral faculties. So now the concentration is there, the breath has become very subtle, that means that the mind is very concentrated. But the energy is the one you got to do, so you're using the mind moving to different points to energize the concentration. Do you see that? I'm not sure you all see it. Do you see what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So there must be at least 6 or 7 different points. After having spent some time in the course of this training, the disciple may feel lazy in his work when he considers that there is no good progress in his training. He should then contemplate lazy. Isn't that lovely? Isn't this just a refreshing practice? It's straightforward. Before he can gain sufficient strength in attentiveness, sati, samadhi, concentration or fixedness of mind, and jnana, insight, they sound familiar to you? The disciple may feel doubtful about the correctness and usefulness of the method of the training itself. So this is what's called resistance, or doubt comes up. And first it will come with a feeling of really being tired. All of a sudden you get really tired. But if you just name that, you don't fall for it, it will pass. In such cases, he should proceed with the contemplation such as doubtful. At times, he may expect and wish for a good result. At times, he might try to remember or think of the way or manner of his having carried out his training. So now you're going to movies, right? At times he may be trying to examine whether the object of contemplation is rupa, or form, or nama, or mind. In such cases he should proceed with a contemplation such as examining. At times he will feel sorry because he does not find any improvement in his contemplation. In such cases, he should proceed with a contemplation such as, sorry. At times, he may feel happy when he thinks that his contemplation is improving. In such cases, he should proceed with his contemplation such as, happy. In this manner, he should make a mental note of every moment of mental behavior as it occurs, and then proceed with his contemplation of rising and falling. Beautiful, isn't it? The period of contemplation from the time of awakening until the disciple falls asleep. And the period of contemplation is from the whole day. And this is why you need to be in retreat to do this, really. Beautiful. It's a very beautiful practice. And, you know, you really do that wild force of consciousness that has been so used to just running through really will kick up its heels a few times. So you want, like, a silence. You want a sense of that you have the right to try this, to see what happens, and you want a sense of trust in whoever it is that's leading the retreat. You want those three things, because you know how rebellious you can be. So you want to make sure those things, and make sure that the good food is going to be there, and you know. It's a very, very worthwhile thing to do with practice. Thus the disciple should be occupied incessantly with his contemplation throughout the day and night. There should be no relaxation whatsoever. This is certainly, again, an omission will occur. But that's the aspiration, as much mindfulness as I can bring. On reaching a certain stage of developing contemplation, the disciple will not feel sleepy at all and will be able to carry on with his contemplation day and night. Whether good or bad, the disciple should contemplate on each mental occurrence. Whether small or big, the disciple should contemplate on each movement of his body and limbs. Whether pleasant or unpleasant, the disciple should contemplate on every sensation of its bodily feeling. Whether good or bad, the disciple should contemplate on every mental object or impression. If there is no special thing, the disciple should be fully occupied with the contemplation of rising and falling. If he has to go on any business, the disciple should contemplate on each step as walking, or left, right. While taking an exercise in walking, the disciple should contemplate on each step by three sections of up, forward, down, or as I was trained, lifting, moving, placing. The disciple who is thus occupied fully with his contemplation throughout the day and night will be able to develop his concentration in order to gain the desirable stage of Udayabhaya Jnana, initial stage of the fourth degree of insight, in no long time, and other higher stages of Vipassana Jnana, up to final achievement. There are two quests that go with the quote from the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. There are two quests, the noble and the ignoble. First, what is ignoble? Take the case of a man who, being himself subject to rebirth, pursues what is no less subject to rebirth. Who, being himself subject to decay, pursues what is subject to disease, death, sorrow, and impurity. What you ask is subject to the round of rebirth, family, children, bondsmen, bondswomen, goats, sheep, fowls, swine, elephants, cattle, horses, mares, gold, silver. All those subjections to birth mark all these ties. Yet a man himself, subject to birth, pursues these things with blind and avid appetite. That quote, that was especially to the bhikkhus. It's very Theravada kind of quote. And Theravada, the idea is basically that men, it has become traditional to believe that men are more likely to awaken than women. So it's not uncommon in the Theravada practice to find translations slightly slanted towards the evils of a female in a man's life. Because I just lead you astray. I'm just so tempted to say this. Should I say it? Because men don't get to go through menopause. I just had to slip it in. It was yesterday we did this whole wonderful dance around it. Quite a lot of fun. You ever heard of Vajrayogini? Kundalini is fire? You have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints about that so far?
Christine, when you're talking about the other, I didn't catch what you're saying. If you're sitting in meditation and you're sleeping and then you come through that, if that's not happening, do you get up and go somewhere and sleep? Is that, you don't actually...
So you do. Like, there are four postures. And one of my beloved teachers was Achan Samatharo in Thailand, a beautiful teacher, who taught Vipassana slightly differently than this, but the same basic principles. And the whole day was divided in these four postures. So when one did a retreat with him, one did an hour and a half of sitting, an hour and a half of walking, an hour and a half of standing, and an hour and a half of lying, 24 hours a day. That was the day. So when you were doing the hour and a half of lying, you would fall asleep. You would fall asleep, but you would fall asleep mindfully. You would be watching the breath or being aware of the posture and follow the breath into sleep. So in your first falling of what we would call falling asleep, usually we think of something. I would challenge you all, how many of you could tell me whether you fall asleep on the in-breath or out-breath tonight? I would like you to watch that and see what you can find. Because usually just before we fall asleep, it's a very scary thing for the ego to lose control like that. So usually we distract ourselves. We have kind of a little movie that we play traditionally. We have our own little way of doing it. We think about the next day, or we, you know, fantasize something, or we find something that somebody did wrong to us and they'll be sorry. Or, you know, we have a favorite little, you know, the motive is there, the name sometimes change to protect the innocent, but it's always the same plot line, and we always run the same movie just as we're, you know, and we fall asleep as the final curtain kind of thing. So if you're doing this kind of meditation, you actually are aware, and if you've been doing it for, like, you know, usually within 2 days of doing the practice on retreat like that, my mind is just right there, just watching, fall asleep, and I'm aware now that I'm asleep, but in the beginning it wasn't, I couldn't tell. And then there's usually this period where, like, you could watch the mind go into deep sleep, Bawanga, Chitta, into deep sleep, and that's like, just like, that's black hole. But then the mind comes out of Bawanga, Chitta, and you can be aware of that, and then it does like the liver cleaning. It's like the night cleaning crew comes into the office. You know, all the ladies with their desk mops, and you want your liver change its cycle. And it's really fascinating. You know, it's like being in the office when it really is. I always thought it was like being in the office when all the staff has gone home, but now the night cleaning crew is there and they're emptying the waste paper basket. So it's like the lights go on and off in different ways all over your body, and this whole different cycling of energy goes on. It's fascinating. So, like, if you actually hold your focus and watch yourself go to sleep, it's just so interesting. You know? It's just so interesting who's really at home. You know, and how many different activities actually go on here. And then you know, one of those things will stop, and then you go back into Bawanga, and then the consciousness comes out again because there's going to be a dream. So you watch the consciousness rise into a dream, is like something triggers, some sensual trigger usually, and then an image will arise, and then usually another image, and then maybe another image, sometimes three, usually four images. It varies. I mean, don't make it a rule of thumb. It can be 20, you know, who cares? But it's not uncommon that it's like three or four images usually. And if you're going to wake up then, or usually if one of them startles you, or you know, your desire nature is triggered, then you wake up a little bit more, a little bit more of a sense of self as opposed to events occurring, and you start stringing them together, the images together, you create a thread that all these four beads are on, which is called your story. So there's the images, and you connect the dots, right? And you got your picture, and then you tell your story about, you know, what the relationship between them all are. Right, so you can watch the mind do that too, which is quite a lot of fun. And you can change, you know, which they call lucid, is that they call it lucid dreaming or something? Yeah? Like, you know, you can change them if you want. Change the motive, you can change the images, throw a new one in. And blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah? Yeah? Is feeling body, or is it something else? Is it energy? Yeah, because there's a lot about sitting, or standing, or rising, falling. That's the basis of the whole practice, isn't it?
Sorry, happy, I mean, how much of that do you need?
You don't let anything in. Whatever is there, you become aware of. Sometimes they are, but there's sometimes the feeling comes and then the thought. Where there is emotion, there's going to be a view. Where there's a view, there's going to be an emotion. For some people, the view comes first and then all the emotions surrounding it. For some people, the emotion comes first and then the view that anchors it. Right? Yeah, I have sat in meditation and all of a sudden had this great sadness. And then a minute later had an understanding of what the sadness was connected to. Have you ever had that experience? I have sat in meditation and had an image arise. And then all of a sudden have emotion arise. Have you had that experience? That's what I'm talking about. So when the image arises, you say, in it. And when the feeling arises, you say, feel it. Right or wrong about any of that or anything like that, you know, because like at various times we all cycle different. Earth that has to do with learning how to have power. The greatest, most powerful mind state you can develop is the mind state of loving kindness. Isn't that interesting? It's the most powerful mind state you can develop, it's the mind state of loving kindness. Because when you're practicing loving kindness, you see the beauty in everything. So you're not split against the world, so every movement is the movement of the entire universe moving together. Putting it very crudely, but maybe that gives you some idea. So then this dome is water, and that represents the seven practices of enlightenment. Remember Tibetan? Seven factors of enlightenment are called the seven royal treasures, and you've run across them, many of you who have done the mandala offering practice in Tibet. Have any of you done that practice, mandala offering? And you know it's got the four directions, and then the four subcontinents. So four directions are basically the four energies, the four elements rising in space. The center, usually, it isn't always said in all the schools anymore, but it is, there's a hong in the center, there's like a golden earth under which is a huge ocean that is, I'm probably not going to remember correctly, seven times bigger than the earth. And then under that is a huge air, which is seven times bigger than the water. Okay? That's how you visualize it. So it's just very much like being on the planet. So our earth masses are not nearly as big as the water masses, and the water masses are floating in air, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And it's just entirely like being in a body. Because the sense of our being, the heart of our being, is floating in an ocean of water, and that is surrounded by space. Okay? And so the mandala represents the outer, the inner, and the mind moving. And so the first is the four elements, and so that's also loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Or desire for peacefulness, desire for prosperity, desire for seduction, passion, and desire for power. Or resenting not having those would be, so then that's the subcontinent of the eight worldly dharmas. The element, the eight worldly dharmas. There's a hong in the center which represents all the propensities. The golden ground, oh mahum, 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 dump it. That's like dissolving all the past manifestations of self, and then you put some more rice on your Namo Gurave, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sangha. Do that three times. You know all this stuff? So you've done mandala offering. It's very beautiful practice. So you turn then three times clockwise. You start always with, okay, this is the golden ground. And it's purified with scented water and stirring with flour. That is to say, it's purified with really desiring to be compassionate for the benefit of all beings, and stirring with flowers and remembering all the good qualities. Myself, all the actions, positive actions of myself and all beings. That's why I'm doing this, right? Then it's adorned Maru, but before Maru there's like a home, which represents all the propensities of one's being. All the possible ways you can be an idiot in this thing. Everything from mass murderer to great savior, the rest of the universe, or savior, whatever. All the possible propensities. And that's going to become Mount Meru, the center of the universe. That's what it's going to become. The understanding of all states of being. So, Hong, and then you put the four quarters is like the four elements. So Hong, which is going to become Mount Meru, arising in space, the four quarters. And then the subcontinents are the eight worldly dharmas, right? And each one of them has the power to bring, if you use it properly, has the power to bring forth a wonderful thing, precious wheel, precious jewel, you know, loving kindness, compassion, sympathy, joy, equanimity. Has a potential to bring forward something beautiful, right? And then you get another ring, and then you get precious wheel, precious jewel. Don't you? Which are the seven factors of enlightenment. And then the last one, which isn't one of the factors of enlightenment, is the kumpa, the vase. Right? So it goes precious wheel, precious jewel, precious queen, precious minister, precious horse, precious elephant, precious general. And then thought. The precious wheel is energy. You're going to offer an energy. Because it can turn, it's a 1,000 stage wheel made of gold from the Zambu River. From a realm that is a manifest based on incredible vast oceans of wholesome actions. This land then opens to support you. The richness of your being is from that billions of moments of good action. It can turn, this wheel is made out of gold from the Zambu River, it can turn unhindered for 1,000 million miles in one day. So this is like called good energy. And shines like the sun. And there isn't any kind of dullness to this energy. Isn't that nice? Turning in the sky, it travels the four directions without obstruction. So it can work with any circumstance, the four directions. It can work with any combination of elements, it can work with any circumstance. That's very beautiful too, isn't it? It's skillful. It's one of the other aspects of energy when it's properly developed, it's skillful. Easily carrying the four divisions of the wheel-turning monarch's army. So all of the possible mind states that lead to victory are easily compatible with energy. You know, some kinds of energy, they're like very pushy and they don't allow awareness to be present. Does that make sense to you? And so that's not what this energy is like. So it's a precious wheel. And you see, when you see the eight symbols, you see the wheel. And the next one is the precious jewel, which looks like this. I don't know if you can see that. It's like about nine different jewels all in one. You see that? And it's fiery kind of. Which fulfilling jewel with nine aspects? It is tranquility. That's what tranquility is. Tranquility of mental factors and consciousness. Which fulfilling jewel with nine aspects? Light radiating from it reaches thousands of leaps. Now, we're not talking onion relative. I mean, it's close though, it's an arm length. So if you had really big leaps, well, maybe Tasmanian leaps. Could be Tassie leaps. probably not Canada meets anything. Do your leeks grow that big here?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Some do, some don't. So only her leeks. Other than that, you can just think arm length. It light radiating from this wish-fulfilling jewel reaches thousands of leaks even in the darkest time. So that is to say, this is a quality that even in the greatest state of despair, if you pay attention, you will feel, experience the light from this. The precious jewel, tranquility. Tranquility. If you pay attention, no matter how full of despair or dark the time may be, you will find somewhere within your heart that quality that knows there is a way, that is tranquil, that has that power of presence. So that's the first quality. There are 9 qualities. Second one, in heat it cools, in coldness it warms. Next one, third, is it assuages thirst. Fourth, it emits a color appropriate for benefiting present circumstances. Do you want a copy of this? You want this? You don't have to write it all down. You can take it. I don't have an extra copy, but if somebody could copy it and give me the original back. There's thousands of Xerox copies of this floating around North America. I might as well have a few around today. The kind of thing I do when I teach regularly, isn't that right? Does everybody in Edmonton have hundreds of little pieces of paper and they always wonder which one they put where? I call myself the Xerox Queen of Canada. Heat it cools, and coldness it warms, it assuages thirst. It emits a color appropriate for benefiting the present circumstances. Tranquility allows you to see what activity is useful. Five colors of light: white, red, yellow, green, and blue. It removes disease for 100 yojanas. Isn't that good? You know what a yojana is? Did I tell you before? It travels because the spoke wheel travels at 500 yojanas in. It's about 500 yojanas in diameter, and that's like 3,500 miles. But you do kilometers here, don't you? So we have to make that, what, about close to 500 kilometers. And basically, that is supposedly the energy or the aura or the how far away you could feel a Buddha. Now, if there's a physical Buddha, that's how far away you could feel in presence. And supposedly, that's how far your own energy actually can reach if you're just working from the physical sense of energy. Mm-hmm. Physical only. Right? So that was part of the wheel. That's what the wheel is also, the energy of your actual manifestation, how far your influence spreads. That more has to do with how far your emotions are felt. That's interesting too. It's nice to do loving kindness, it's a prayer for beings, and the whole neighborhood starts feeling better, actually it does, actually. It emits color, yeah. It removes disease for 100 yojanas. So 500 yojanas is about 3,500 miles, so you can figure it out. But you'll get the piece of paper and you've got your calculators and you can work that out. I didn't bother trying. It prevents evil nagas from causing calamity, especially torrential rain. It prevents overpourings of negative thoughts and like that kind of thing, the kind of madness it creates. It prevents the tranquility of mental factors, prevents insanity from improper use of kundalini. Sadness, abysses, isolated areas, unfavorable circumstances become the cause for wisdom. They're all just, of course, aren't they, when you hear them? It prevents untimely death and or unfavorable rebirth and causes enemies to act harmoniously. It removes poverty, fulfills prayers, and brings into being whatever the king, the Chakravartin, thinks of, that is perception of cause and effect, knowing how to act. It comes up with tranquility. So the next one is concentration, which is the precious queen. And I remember teaching this with Jeff at the Dharma Center, and people getting really angry with this. So I kind of like that. You know. You wouldn't know how much I would enjoy that. Precious queen, which represents concentration, one-pointedness. Her body gives off the scent of sandalwood. Your sense of smell is very profoundly attached to some very powerful reactions of your being. For example, they're now starting to explore why people fall in love. And it has to do with being able to smell a smell from the other that you don't actually physically aren't aware of the aroma, but it's a chemical reaction through the sense of smell to the brain. So now they're starting to commercially, isn't that interesting? Commercially develop them so that people can fall in love for a weekend and then forget it the next. I mean, that's exactly what happens. I mean, only in America. Pity. So this is like a very long time ago. This is like 900 years ago, where we're talking about the scent, the power of scent. First, body gives off the scent of the sandalwood. When you develop concentration, remember I said something about that dimmer switch goes off in your awareness? Like, that's right, your reality shifts. That has something to do with the oldest part of the brain and the sense of smell. It's connected there. And sometimes you do smell different. When there's concentration, actually, some people do actually smell different things, but there is always that shift of perception. Her breath is like the perfume of an Utpala flower. Utpala flower, that means that that the experience of it moves beyond self. That is, that concentration can go into boundless states. The Utpala is the lotus in Tibetan tradition. Is this all this stuff interesting to you, these little details, or should I just get right on? Okay, there are two types of lotus in the Tibetan tradition. One is called the ordinary lotus, and the other is the Utpala, which is a blue lotus. Ordinary lotus is what seed comes from the mud, from our struggles, grows up finally only because of some kind of light reaching or some kind of call. The seed moves through the mud. It grows up through these currents, you know, just like when you're listening to something and then something else catches you and moves you away, and then this current moves you enough. And they're kind of muddy currents, but there's still some kind of light that keeps you moving, right? Isn't there? And then eventually even, you know, although sometimes the currents can get very powerful, eventually it breaks above the surface. It goes usually about a foot above the surface, and then it opens. And when the flower opens, it's pristine, it's transcendent. There is no sign of any mud or muddy water or... And it's like a total transcendent experience that arises from mud. It goes through three different mediums into the third medium. Like totally, it's totally a transcendent experience, right? So that is basically the relative bodhicitta. That's what it means. It's the bodhicitta that arises, the mind to awaken that arises based on becoming aware of the struggle, slowly becoming. It's called relative bodhicitta. It is the desire to awaken not only for yourself but for the benefit of all beings. And it has two kinds. One is wishing, that's when you're still in the mud. And the other is performing, that's when you actually are opening up above, right? And there are all kinds of symbols that go with that, like the bees that sip the nectar of that and the, you know, the experience that that is and blah, 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 goes on and on. So I don't want to go too far more into that. But then the other kind of flower is called the Utpala. It's a blue flower. When it opens, all the other lotuses close. That's what an Utpala flower is. This is not the actual Utpala. Her breath is like the perfume of an Utpala flower. Pala flower, when it opens, all the other lotus close, because this is absolute bodhicitta. This is the experience of totality, where all beings are awakened. Right? So there is no relative. And in concentration for a moment, in samadhi for a moment, all of the kaleshas, all of the defilements of consciousness have temporarily settled. So there's just for a moment of clarity. And there is a taste and a hint of what it would be like to have a clear mind. So her breath is like the perfume of Utpala flower. Is this interesting to you to start to understand how the symbolism is used in the Tibetan? I think it's nice to know what these things actually... It helps me when I'm reading a meditation, I get it, I know it. So they're holding a lotus or they're holding an Utpala, then I know, oh, this is relative bodhicitta, oh, this is absolute bodhicitta. Not that I can pull either one up at the drop of a hat or shoe or door key or anything, but that at least I know where to aim my mind. At least I know how to hold the consciousness. So that gives me a greater sense of willingness to actually move with the tradition. So I'm hoping that's interesting to you. Being in her presence removes discomfort, both mental and physical. Being in the presence of someone who is an absolutely perfect consort. Her hips doesn't matter, but in this case, in a nurturing way. In terms of relationship, not in terms of directing energy. Okay? No person or event can distract one from the joy of her company. And any of you have ever had an experience of absorption, you know that. You don't even know what else is happening. Okay. Is that true? Whether it's a shock or whatever it is, when you're like totally absorbed, you don't see anything else. But it's really very profound. It's like almost the things break down into like snapshots. Awareness. I've had that experience. Someone else has? Some of you have? Yeah. She is both mother and sister to those who renounce negative states and actions through recognizing at one moment. Her union with the beloved is total and respectful, without argument. It was okay up to this point. Now we start getting a little icky in Toronto, in Ontario. She is without the five faults of a woman.
Can we have the
I'm about to name. Thinking of other men. And we all know, don't we, that that's not what you should do, don't we know that? You don't do that, do you? Certainly not. I'll stop playing. I'll just read it. Miserliness. Okay? Miserliness. Of holding back. Attachment to the improper. Fondness for unsuitable things. That's exactly the same place in Toronto that everybody says, what does that mean? Especially the women. What does that mean? It took me about half an hour to escape from that. And the last one, a hatred toward her lover. So these are all analogies for ways of interrupting concentration. Not surrendering into concentration. Did you look at them?
Yeah.
So this is how in the Tibetan they use analogies to help you, if you haven't had the experience yourself, at least pretend you know what it is. Well, it works with this dream. It's a very skillful way of working, I think. But if you don't know the culture, it can be a little, you know, like an oot what? And the five qualities of a precious consort. And this is big trouble. Adapts her thoughts. Bears many sons. At this point, everybody had forgotten we were talking about concentration. Well, that's a very cultural way of describing it, somebody said to me. Adapt to thoughts, right, because concentration adapts to whatever is present. Just, you know, interest and then concentration flows right with it. Bears many sons. When you come out of concentration, the little moments of investigation and interest, the thoughts that arise, are profoundly different. There is a quality of joy and interest in them, a willingness to be present. It's very different, and it lasts a long time. There is incense. Brings harmony. There is a satisfaction that arises from experiencing real concentration that causes that kind of craving energy to just dissolve. And you have a real sense of knowing what home is, and it's not separate from everybody around. So you have this sense of really talking from there and seeing that in others, how to have that sense of harmony. Like, that's what's valuable. Peacefulness is what's valuable, and so that's where you're talking from. Has a positive effect in the community. Well, if you're concentrated, you're not so likely to be throwing bombs. And doesn't feel jealous if her consort thinks of other women. That's very straightforward, though, in terms of concentration, isn't it? There isn't any if you have a state of concentration and then your mind is doing the dishes or you're thinking about what you should make for dinner, there isn't something niggling up from the previous mind thought. Whereas if you're angry about something and you're trying to think about something else, the anger is like jealous. You know, can you see that? As well, she has the three qualities of a woman of excellent family. Now we're getting the clam into it. Does not speak foolishly. That is to say, she was well trained. Doesn't hold wrong views. Is not like me. And doesn't indulge in sensual pleasures when her consort is absent. They certainly involve the imagination, don't they? I mean, these are images that you actually think about, aren't they? They easily bring images up, don't they? Pardon? Yeah. For all beings, but monks in particular. Because they don't have very many women around them like that. You know, so it's fascinating, isn't it? So this is what concentration will do, you see. I know you're thinking about a love affair, but why don't you practice this concentration? Because it will be a perfect concentration. And there were no nuns in Tibet. The ordination for women didn't get to Tibet. been rectified now, but they're interesting, huh? Women weren't actually taught. Very few. Another little known fact about Tibetan Buddhism. Precious Minister Investigation of Dharma, Dhammavicaya, he manages the work for the king without needing guidance. Lovely. Investigation, the mind of investigation. If you ask a question and then you let it go, you hold, you focus on the question. If you want something, you focus on that question, then you drop it. You offer it up or you drop it. You don't need to keep going back. If you ask a question honestly, your mind will look for the answer, and when the answer is found, it will go, you got mail. Always will do that. Mind will always do that. Isn't that nice to know? Whereas if you brood on it and worry about it, you're basically desiring an experience other than that, which is present, you're causing yourself pain, you're creating difficulty for the people around you, especially those who love you. Is that clear? So then you might want to ask yourself, why do you want to not be present? So you've got a really good way of not being present if you do that. And nobody can take it away from you, because like that would be like being unfeeling about your suffering, wouldn't it? Especially if they love you. I mean, nobody can come in and say, like, you know, like, what about lunch? Did you see my shoe polish? Because they wouldn't be being sensitive to your pain. So you can sort of say to yourself, you know, like, why is it I don't want to be with these people? And ask that with real kindness. Why don't I want to be with these people? Because you'll probably get an answer. You know, you ask that question, any question you ask, you're going to get an answer. A wonderful thing is that he manages to work for the king without needing guidance. You can ask a question about anything. What is smart? What is constant? And then you get on with practicing kindness with what you do have. And if that question is important for you to be going there in your life, pretty soon what you do have will transmute into what it is you're asking for. This is the wish-fulfilling jewel. Whatever we ask for, we do get. So if I'm not getting what I'm asking for, I should ask myself whether there's something else that I'm asking for, like I'm asking to not get what I'm asking for, maybe, or, you know what I'm saying? Or is there a better way of getting it other than the way I focused on? I wanted for years to have a child, and I couldn't have a child, as I was barren. I spent a lot of time with that, you know, and going to women's meetings was very interesting. You know, all these women get together and they all talk about whether or not they should have an abortion. Yeah. Sitting in the corner with a smile on your face. And so they, okay, well, when what am I going to do here? What am I going to do? Well, I have to grow the child of Dharma in my own heart and nourish it wherever I find it in the world. I got more kids. You'd be surprised how many kids I got. I've got kids everywhere. I can go just about anywhere in the world. And some kid will walk up to me. And some of them say, you know, you like this one. Do you remember me? I used to come to your classes. And the strangest places in the world, these kids come up. Grown up so well, you know. The crooked teeth, you know, the clock foot, all disappeared. Wonderful. Investigation, you hold a question and then you get on with what is in front of you. This is a wish-fulfilling realm. Whatever you ask for, you will get. It won't necessarily come in the wrapping paper you're asking. The gift will be the same. But you might not like the wrapping paper. Too bad. I'm so sorry. Investigation of Dharma. So stainless is his loyalty. So stainless is the power of our being. That whatever you ask for, you can get. Absolutely. His eyes see treasures buried under the earth, buried under billions of possibilities of cause and effect. You ask for something, and out of all of the possibilities, that's what will come to you. One person named Cecily will meet you in Tasmania. Out of all the people. One person here, one. He is without hypocrisy and harms no sentient being. There is no warping of truth in it. It's very direct, very straightforward. And there is no harm in it. This is one of the ways you can tell when you are working with Dharma, if this investigation of Dharma begins to occur more easily in your life. One of the ways where you can tell you're doing good practice or you're working with a good teacher is that you get what you want. Or they say, cause and effect speeds up. Or seeds of karma ripen faster. You know, things happen at a faster pace in your life. He is untiring in his activities. He has no attachment to worldly things, but is not swayed from his dedication to investigation for the purpose of knowing the truth. This is the non-duality of wisdom and method. So then comes precious elephant, which is equanimity. It's got six trunks. Because that's the six paramis in the Tibetan. They have six paramis in the Theravada, they have ten. Those six paramis, or the parami means the completing or the finishing or the crossing over. They are the actions that allow one to complete, and they're basically like the ten marks of sila. Paramis are generosity, morality, which is the ten marks of sila, patience, I get them mixed up with this, effort, concentration, this one, and wisdom, in the Tibetan. I get them mixed up when I start trying to do them, so. Mixed up with the Theravada, you don't mix with it. So then, from the God realm, he is shining white in color and bears six tusks representing the perfection of the six paramis. Other elephants make way for him as soon as they catch his scent. It's like the lotuses disappear as soon as they. And when there is equanimity there, all activity, all other possible ways of moving just he is invincible on land, in water, and in space. True equanimity does not move. Is unbeatable. In one day, he can easily complete two trips to Jambudvipa. I think that should be Jambu, but I've got Jambu. But who cares? Jambudvipa. He completely understands the rider's wishes, therefore needs no guidance. He moves with grace, in harmony with his environment. So even little children are not frightened of him, but even while engaged in battle, he can be led by a slender cord. So this is equanimity, means an ability to see all things with evenness of consciousness. So there is never any fixed, there's not a view that you're holding to. Does that make sense? So nothing to protect, so even, the slightest change, can't go the other way, no problem. Riding this elephant, the king is invincible. And the elephant has the ten powers of a Buddha, which are like these 13 umbrellas, and 10 of them are the powers, and 3 are the knowledges of a Buddha. It means that the equanimity is the state. It has to do with being able to see cause and effect. Equanimity is when you can, like your beautiful question about the hungry. when you can see the activity of the entire universe as actually the dance of awakening. You know how it is that, and you know how to move with it for the benefit of all beings. That you're not hurt by some things. And does that make sense? What I think you really wish for. So that's what this is. So when there is a clear perception of universal truth, and while at the same time to be able to see individual movements of cause and effect, that's called equanimity, like this. So that's what he represents, and that's why the 10 powers of a Buddha, he is able to see all possible ways of cause and effect. He has all the knowledges of a fully awakened being. And that's equanimity, which is I think we would get it confused easily by thinking that disinterest is not the same thing, because disinterest is a dullness, a not seeing all of the activity, all of the cosmic effect, or is it different notion? Precious Horus means rapture, peepee. He is like a peacock's neck in color. His coat grows in swirls and patterns that manifest the designs of all the auspicious symbols. This is the word that makes flesh. He can move over lotus flowers. Remember lotus flowers? Anything that's moving from the mud up. He can move over lotus flowers on lakes without causing the slightest ripple or mark of his passage. He travels to and from Jambu Divita in 2 hours. His going is so swift it meets no resistance. His body is vibrant with health, and he can easily manifest the 2 miraculous powers of fire and water. That is to say, he is the dance of male and female, the union of both. Precious warrior, householder, which is mindfulness, sati, he's very powerful and courageous. When he is active, all unwholesome places are transformed into jewel habitats. Because he does not cheat or deceive, he is welcome in all places. So when mindfulness is present, all unwholesome activity is changed. So, if you're confused and mindfulness is present, you're not confused anymore, you're mindful of confusion. Your main action is mindfulness. Which is the whole secret, isn't it, of Anapanasati, of the foundation of mindfulness. To train yourself to be continuously involved in the activity of mindfulness. When he is active, all unwholesome places are transformed into jewel habitat. Everything is a possibility. Everything is a possible moment of awakening. The stupa is a jeweled habitat, a jeweled mansion, or anything like that. You find a lot of that in the Tibetan tradition. That means the stupa. That's what the jeweled habitat is. The mansion within which you will awaken is the milieu of awakening. And the central thing that will create the awakening is mindfulness. Because the awakening is present, it's not something you have to get. So you actually have to be here and mindful to identify it. Because he does not cheat or deceive, he is welcome in all places. He is wise in commanding the 4 groups of the army by giving specific directions in battle. Or he is wise in interacting with, if he's a warrior. And as a warrior, he is always fighting the great fiend of ignorance, either willful or non-willful, ignoring. That's who the enemy is. And, or if he's a householder thing, wise in interacting with the four castes of society, which are royal, priestly, middle caste, and lower caste. He's wise in that through the pragmatic nature of his wisdom. Wherever he fights, he is victorious without causing harm to the defeated. By offering prayers to him, one becomes victorious over conflicting emotions and martyrs. Those are the seven factors of enlightenment when they were in Tibetan, represented in the Tibetan, as I think I mentioned that I might talk about them more fully. And then the seven factors described in Anapanasati Sutra: on whatever occasion a monk abides, contemplating the body as body, feelings as feelings, mind as mind, and mind object as mind object, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. On that occasion, unremitting mindfulness is established in him. That's straightforward. Abiding thus mindful, he investigates and examines whatever is present. Therefore, investigation of Dharma arises. He investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks